Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 188 of my radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. You can listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the internet, or subscribe to the podcast using iTunes or other similar programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Just remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. I don't know you're a listener unless I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it, what you don't like about it. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. And I still have a few bookmarks left, and I have a new printer on order, so more will be coming. If you would like to sponsor the show, please contact me. You can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. Even $1 or $2 a month makes a difference. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting, appreciate you suggesting guests, and I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks most of all for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. I'm an optimist, really, which is pretty surprising considering some of the issues I get involved with, where change seems hopeless, arrayed against powerfully well-funded, monolithic, and heartless establishments. But this week's interview focuses not on a success, but a failure. Attempts to find HIV particles in human blood using an electron microscope have always failed, even when the viral load is in the millions. Yet, when the blood is spiked with lab-cultured viral particles, they are easily seen. So, a company that provided this service would be a big threat to the HIV/AIDS dogma establishment. In fact, electron microscopy was critical in the acquittal or reduced sentences of several members of the American military who had been charged with exposing other people to HIV. A company like this is dangerous and therefore must be shut down. And this is today's story related to me by Dr. David Rasnick. Let's listen. David Rasnick is an expert in drug development, responsible for synthesizing the first peptidyl fluoromethanes, which I'm sure he can tell us all about. He was a member of the Presidential AIDS Advisory Panel of South America under President Thabo Mbeki around 2000.
South Africa.
Oh, did I say South America? South Africa. Yeah. Okay, sorry about that. Worked with Peter Duisberg on the aneuploidy theory of cancer, and he's been a critic of the HIV/AIDS dogma for a long time. Based on this, he helped found Viral Forensics to provide electron microscope and analysis of blood for HIV particles. And today, we will discuss the rise and fall of this company. Welcome back to The Infectious Myth, David Rasnick, or to avoid confusion with our first names, Raz.
Thanks, Crow. It's a pleasure to be back with you. I think this is the quickest we've ever done them sort of back to back.
Yeah. I think last time we talked about Ebola, which seems to have faded from the news recently, but it comes up, I think, every time somebody needs funding for a vaccine or the World Health Organization feels the need for more attention.
Or there'll be another virus, a new one.
Yes. Well, they got to Z or Z with Zika, so I think they have to start at A again.
Yeah.
Or maybe this time they'll just number them. So why do you need an electron microscope to look for HIV in somebody's blood?
Well, you know, as a scientist, you try to use the best evidence that you have available at the time. And viruses and bacteria are in the realm of what's called microbiology, infectious agents, bacteria, yeast, viruses, and other little organisms. And the things about these microorganisms are two things. One, they're very small, and the other one is that they're active. They're active biologically. They replicate. Bacteria can replicate on their own, independent of a host. Viruses are parasites. They're obligate parasites. They absolutely have to infect a cell of another species in order to replicate. Bacteria, you can see them with a light microscope. You can culture them and grow them in a petri dish, like people had done and started doing very consistently in the 19th century. And they use light microscopes, visual microscopes, to see those little guys. And with viruses, you do pretty much the same thing. You have to culture them in other cells, as I said. But once those viruses are produced in those other cells, you can actually visualize them with a more powerful microscope, the electron microscope. So the electron microscope is the tool of choice when you're trying to detect and characterize viruses. That, along with culturing the virus to see whether or not it's viable.
Can you tell that something is a virus versus, say, a microvesicle or some other organelle just by looking at it under an electron microscope?
Well, an expert can. An expert electron microscopist can definitely do that. I'm not an expert electron microscopist. I've worked with them. I've collaborated with them. And sometimes these little vesicles, which are easily produced in vitro in the laboratory, they're artifacts of cell culture. And many of them actually look like viral particles. But fortunately, all of the classes of viruses, there's no new class of viruses for a long time now, have been characterized using electron microscopy, the ones that you can actually work with. For example, hepatitis C has never been observed with electron microscope, so there's some serious doubt as to whether or not hepatitis C even exists. But all of the real viruses that people look at, Ebola and these others, they have well characterized and recognized physical properties that you can also look at on the electron microscope, and you can say whether or not it's this class of virus, that class of virus, or retrovirus, or whatever. So for the people who know what they're doing and have a lot of experience, it's really not a very big deal. It's actually easier for electron microscopists to do that than it is for a pathologist, say, to look at a cancer tissue and say whether or not it's normal or abnormal.
Right. But, I mean, if you saw something under an electron microscope like HIV, for example, we're talking, say, in the 1980s, you have a particle and you look at it and your electron microscope expert says, I think this is a virus. But wouldn't you need to purify those particles and determine that even if it's a virus, how do you know it's the same as, say, the RNA that you're looking at that you think is associated with the virus? Like if you have RNA that, say, is from HIV, can you look in an electron microscope and know that the same RNA is in those particles?
No, you can't. For example, at that conference that we attended, I showed some cultured HIV that was acquired ultimately back from the National Institutes of Health at the Robert Gallo's lab. And you could see a certain fraction of those little spheres, the little particles, were hollow. They had no they did not stain with urinal acetate, which meant there was no genetic material inside that little vesicle.
Mm-hmm.
So that was clearly, no matter what else you can say for a fact that that is not infectious, viable virus. You can say that for a fact. Now, the other particles that had the dark center with a little halo around it, those were claimed to be HIV. So we take the word for it. That was the label on the bottle. And sure enough, those are reproducible particles. They look like they have the dimensions of retroviruses. There's, I think, 3,000 retroviruses that people have cataloged in rodents and other animals. Mm-hmm. And those properties of retroviruses biochemically and using electron microscope are fairly well understood. What you could do with electron microscope, you can say something, especially if you're an experienced person, you can say whether or not there's viral particles there and give the family of the type of virus. But you cannot say what specifically genus, for example, genus right. or species of virus it is. So you could definitely say whether or not, let's say it's a retrovirus or not a retrovirus, but you can't say which retrovirus. You can't say it's HIV or right. simian immunodeficiency virus or all those other ones that people claim to have around.
In some cases, like we'll get to the court cases in a little while, but you're actually as interested in the HIV not being there as being there. And so how do you prove that something's not there? Maybe you just didn't look hard enough. What's your strategy for being able to say we're pretty sure that HIV is not present in this sample?
Okay, what we were going to do at Viral Forensics was to use the gold standards for virology. One of the clearest things is that if you take your reference standard, remember I said we had some virus that came from ultimately from the National Institutes of Health, and we were able to add that virus, spike it into a sample of human plasma that had no detectable virus in it. And then sure enough, you could see that virus in that blood plasma sample so that you could say, aha, the properties of this virus, we can definitely, the blood plasma does not obscure the properties of that virus. We can see the dense little center of the virus with the RNA in it and the little halo around it and the right dimensions. It was like 110 to 120 nanometers. So we say, aha, what the NIH says, this is HIV, we say, aha, we can see what they call HIV in the blood plasma when we put it in there.
And when you're working with this, with these particles, you have a known quantity of particles per yes. unit volume?
Yes, we do.
Right. So the viral load test claims, like when it says a million, is that like a million particles per milliliter?
No.
I mean,
no.
is that what it's supposed to be? We'll talk about what
no,
it really is.
You're off by a factor of two.
Okay.
Retrovirus, HIV has two strands of RNA in its little genome, two strands. So once those viral load tests for HIV, they explicitly say there's so many copies of the RNA there. But they implicitly say that there's viral particles in there because they have one of the steps where they lyse the viral particles to free it out of its little sphere of proteins that shelter and protect it so that they can actually do PCR on the RNA once it's released. So they wouldn't incorporate that step of lysing the viral particles if they didn't implicitly believe that that's what they are actually assaying for, a real intact infectious particles of HIV in the blood plasma. All right, so now maybe
it was a simpler question. I was just asking what units, like say a million, are they saying a million particles per milliliter or what?
No, they're saying RNA, copies of RNA. So there's two copies of RNA per viral particle. So if it's a million, divide by two.
So 500,000.
Should be a half million of viral particles.
Okay. So I guess what I'm getting to is if you have this laboratory virus and let's say that you have 500,000 particles per milliliter of this laboratory virus and you spike the blood, you should be able to see a viral load of 500,000.
Yeah, absolutely you do. In the spike sample.
Okay, so how low can you go in terms of the density of particles and still see it in the spiked plasma?
Right. Yeah, those numbers have varied over the years. Nowadays, the absolute limit that was developed in Canada a few years ago, they're able to get down to around 100 viral particles per milliliter. 100.
Are we talking about electron microscope detection?
Yes. That's even better than PCR.
Okay.
Okay. and the approach that they used and that we were going to use had we stayed in business, they have these nano filters. They have these little filters and these little grids where you actually can just take the raw stuff, but we're going to, I'll just keep it really simple. What these guys did in Canada, they were looking for viral detection using EM for like terrorism. This funded for terrorism. They wanted
you can always get money for terrorism.
Right. They had the ability out in the field, and these trucks that they drive around, they have biosafety level 3 and 4 labs in the field, and they want to be able to analyze those things. And the EM is the quintessential detector and characterizer of viruses. So that was part that was absolutely essential for this assay. So they had to be able to get down to very, very low quantities. And these guys developed a method, a very simple, inexpensive, just a few $100 method, where they filtered a biological sample through these porous electron microscope grids. Mm-hmm. And the virus is bigger than the holes in the grids, but lets the plasma and other stuff go through. And it captures and concentrates the virus on the grid. And they were able to get down to about 100 particles per milliliter.
Okay, so what that basically means is if viral load really does mean that there is X particles per milliliter, that you could detect any detectable level of viral load. Because under a certain level, they say undetectable because we can't find it, right? So any detectable level, you would be able to see with electron microscope if viral load is actually counting particles.
That's true.
Right. So what has been your experience with EM on plasma, not spiked, but actually with blood of people with a detectable viral load?
Right. Well, my personal experience is we've never seen any HIV or anything that comes close to looking like HIV or any other retrovirus in any plasma sample over a period of a few years when it goes all the way back to OMSJ.
And what are some of the viral load numbers that you were playing with in terms of these people?
They were up as high as 5 million.
So there's no question about whether you should be able to see it or not.
That's right.
But you're looking at 5 million viral load, and that's way above the level at which you'd be able to detect. And you're not seeing HIV-like particles.
No, not at all. And nobody else has anywhere in the world.
And so what happened when you went to court with this information? Like, let's talk about the case of Randy Stevens, U.S. Navy.
Right.
I think he was one of the first.
Yeah, I was trying to look at my... Oh, here it is. I have my... PowerPoint presentation that I gave, and I got to look up Randy Stevens, remind myself about this guy. He was one of the first people that viral forensics got his blood plasma, where we spiked it at University of Massachusetts, I believe it was. Hendrickson, he was the fellow at University of Massachusetts at Worcester. Mm-hmm. He was a consultant for OMSJ, and we got some HIV from a fellow by the name of Gottlinger, professor in the same building as Hendricks, and it was the same HIV, came from Robert Gallo's lab at the NIH, and we got that and spiked it into Stephen's blood, and his blood before we spiked it had no detectable retroviruses. There had a little what's called adeno-associated virus in his blood plasma, which is totally harmless. It's about 1/5 the size of HIV and doesn't look anything like a retrovirus. But when we spiked his blood plasma with the Gottlinger's HIV, we immediately, within seconds, were able to, every field on the EM grid, we were able to see several viral particles of HIV, the same morphology, the same sizes that we saw in the pure stuff. So it was easy.
And what happened in court when you brought that evidence into court?
Well, we didn't actually use this in his case because he pled guilty. He did what was called a plea bargain. You know, so we didn't actually use that information in the courtroom.
Did the prosecution know that you had it?
Not in that case, because this was viral forensics. The prosecution knew when the ZOMSJ, we were using other people.
Mm-hmm.
I may be getting this confused, OMSJ and viral forensics. We had used other people before that. I can't remember which ones. I think in the University of Chicago or some places like that. And there was no. They did show the negative results, and they weren't really definitive in the sense that one reason why we won the cases or lost the cases. We usually won these court cases based on the ELISA inserts that go with the antibody test and the Western
right.
blot test, and also with the viral load test. They all say that you cannot use those tests to screen for the presence of HIV or to confirm the presence of HIV.
Right.
That's usually how we win it. We started using the EM when the prosecutors lost too many times to us on the ELISA or the antibody test, and they started touting the importance of viral load. So that's when we brought in the electron microscopy, and of course that was very, very powerful evidence, negative evidence,
mm-hmm.
you know. And unfortunately, the early studies with OMSJ, they did not have HIV as a reference standard. All they could do was just take their blood plasma and look at it under the EM. They didn't see anything. But what viral forensics, what we did, we laid our hands on HIV itself.
Right, which is much more powerful, because they could claim, if you're just looking at the plasma under an electron microscope and you don't see anything, they could say there's some problem with your preparation or something like that. But if you can spike it with particles and you can immediately see them, then that's a lot harder to say that there's some issue with your preparation technique.
I'll tell you what else we were going to do. Mm-hmm. Since we had viable, infectious, culturable HIV, this did not come from a human being. This came from a laboratory.
Right.
All right. This HIV. But you could definitely culture it in the laboratory. This was the HIV that we spiked into the blood plasma. Now, what we were going to do was show that once we spike that HIV at the appropriate level for viral load purposes,
mm-hmm.
that we could go back and reculture it from the blood plasma.
Right.
So if we could do that, now we did not get to that point, obviously, because we're going to talk about a little later, we got shut down prematurely. But then you'd have both legs of the gold standard. You have the viability assay, which is culturing. And you'd have the microscopic or the visual assay using electron microscopy. And that's the best you can do in virology.
Right. And so if you could culture this lab virus from a spiked sample, and then taking the unspiked sample and performing the same culturing process, and if you didn't right. get anything, that would be double evidence
exactly.
that there's nothing there.
And everything we were going to do is going to do parallel well, the unspiked and the spike sample.
Right. Okay. So things took a turn for the worse when a woman named Sheila Peel got involved in the Gavin Atchak case. So can you discuss what happened there?
Yeah. Sheila Peel, she's the director of the HIV diagnostics at Walter Reed Army Hospital in Maryland, I guess. Bethesda, I think it is there. And she had been, she came into the OMSJ cases towards the end of OMSJ when we kept winning the package inserts arguments for the ELISA and the Western blot test, the antibody test. And then they started touting the superior quality of the viral load. So, and she had been an expert witness that actually lost. She and I locked horns more than once. In these cases, and she lost. I think she lost every case
mm-hmm.
With us. I can't say that for a fact because I wasn't involved in every case. But she was really concerned about us introducing electron microscopy evidence into the courtroom. In fact, in her affidavit that I presented at the conference, she said she deduced that the defense seeks to conduct TEM, that's electron microscopy, on Atchak's plasma and present the findings as proof that he is not infected with HIV, which her viral load says he is infected with
mm-hmm,
HIV.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big concern to her. So then the other bit of information that I'm not sure anybody outside at that conference knew about was that she urged the prosecutor, military lawyer prosecutor, Captain Rosenau, to put pressure on the University of Massachusetts to stop Hendricks from working with us. And the words that she used was to stop him from diagnosing HIV.
Right. And she would probably say, well, EM's not you're not allowed to diagnose HIV with EM. It's not approved by the FDA. But was that what Hendricks was doing?
No, he was not. In fact, Hendricks said he was not diagnosing or treating HIV at all, as Peel claimed. He used TEM to determine if HIV could be detected at the current viral load. And interestingly enough, the University of Massachusetts agreed with him and supported his argument about that. Mm-hmm. That's what he was doing. He'd actually done the same thing in a number of court cases before we even knew who he was.
Right.
So, and the thing about Peel is absolutely correct. The TEM has not been approved by FDA for anything, but the vast majority of diagnostic tests have not been approved by the FDA. They've been what's called grandfathered in. They were available and being used for diagnostic purposes decades before the FDA got involved in this stuff. For example, light microscopes that pathologists use to diagnose cancer or infectious diseases are also not approved by the FDA.
Right,
they're
right.
Grandfathered in. In fact, the overwhelming majority of diagnostic procedures and tests are not approved. So that was a bogus argument. That would sound powerful to, let's say, if it was a jury or something like
right,
that.
Right.
Total nonsense.
Yes. So that doesn't sound like a very good thing for a prosecution to be going to a supplier of the defense and sort of implying that they shouldn't be working for the defense. I mean, isn't that like witness, threatening
tampering.
Witness tampering?
It's witness tampering. In fact, the judge concluded that Rosenau had, in the judge's terms, exerted military language, unlawful command influence, which is their fancy phrase of saying witness tampering. And he directed the government to locate and fund another TEM expert, another electron microscopy expert, for the defense. He gave us 2 months to do that.
Right.
And we couldn't find anybody. The academic EM people were closed to us. So the judge gave us another 3 months. So we wound up having 5 months to try to find somebody to replace Hendricks, and we couldn't do it. And no surprise there. Hendricks was not a full professor. He was... He even said that it would be career suicide for him to continue working with us, even though he was supported by his own university. And he's absolutely right. He could have been fired. I think he's still working there, but I don't know. He could have been fired at will, really.
Right, right. And he was the electron microscope guy.
Yeah.
But you eventually came up with what you thought was a solution to this. Like when you moved to the East Coast, you relocated Viral Forensics, which was supposed to be doing this on a routine basis, to the East Coast. So if you didn't have Hendricks, who was going to be doing your EM?
Oh, we had Siva Wu. She's an electron microscopist expert from Southern California. She worked at UC Berkeley for a while. We hired her. She
right.
had, I forget, 15 years EM experience, and we hired Siva to do the EM for us. And the problem was that the first lab, the QB3 facility, which was administered by University of California, Berkeley, they didn't throw us out or anything, but they wouldn't let us bring in HIV or any other human virus into the original facility. So we realized we had to have HIV for the reasons that you pointed out in the courtroom. You could always hem and haw and argue, well, they didn't really use HIV, demonstrate that they could actually see HIV because so we don't know that they could actually see it if it were there. So we realized we had to have the reference virus, and we had to find some place where we could either buy HIV or grow it, culture it ourselves. We spent 6 months at another lab north of Berkeley designing a lab that was eventually killed at the 11th hour by the the big shot CEO back in China. So we wasted 6 months and a lot of money just doing that. And Bob Lepo, the dauntless Bob Lepo, he still said, hey, guys, we're not giving up. Let's search the country and possibly the continental United States and even Puerto Rico, see if we can't find what's called a biosafety level 3 lab where we could actually grow HIV. All you need is a biosafety level 2. But we didn't want to have any problems, so we decided to ramp it up a little, search for a biosafety level 3 lab. Couldn't find any in California, but we found the what appeared to be the perfect lab in North Carolina. It was called Gateway University Research Park. It had everything we needed. Everything we needed.
Right.
There was one problem. I mean, it had the BSL-3 lab. It had the electron microscope. They even had HIV there.
Right, already.
That we could already there. And everything was going fine, but there was a problem. This was another Gateway University Research Park. Was administered by two universities, University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and also Agricultural and Technical University, also at Greensboro. And on August 31st of 2017, I got an email while I was back in California with Terry and I were packing up all our stuff, ready to ship it out from California to Greensboro. I got an email saying that they had terminated our lease.
And what was the reason they gave?
No reason, not to this day. Nobody has given us any reason, and there was no warning at all. It just happened just like that. And I still haven't met any of those guys or talked to them since I left there. But before I left, one of the guys, a very nice fellow, I'm not going to name names right now for these fellows, but he was the dean of JSNN, the Joint School of Nanoscience and Nanotechnology. He was very, very good to us. He and the executive director of the Gateway University Research Park, they were both very, very good guys, supportive of us. They even bought us very expensive equipment, centrifuges that we thought we were going to have to pay for, but they did it for us just out of the kindness of their hearts. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the director sent us to cut it short. The fellow who was the founding dean at the Joint School of Nanoscience and Nanotechnology, I asked him, I said, Jim, what's going on? And he said, David, they don't want you here. And of course, University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and also A&T University.
And this is part of what's called Research Triangle, right?
Yeah. And not Research Triangle. That's it. That's near Raleigh. This is called Gateway University Research Park.
Okay.
Now let me tell you something. These two guys, we met, the three of us on our team, HIV expert, consultant that we hired, our EM expert, Siva Wu, and I met with the executive director and the dean, closed door, and in April, before we moved down there, to warn them that they could experience pressure from outside, that they should look up a website, do an internet search on OMSJ, me, David Rastnick personally, and other stuff, and you know to see whether or not they really wanted to have us there. And they said, and they convinced us. Of course, we wanted to be convinced. I have to admit that they had been through lots of political battles before, that they could weather this. So we said, okay, great. But you know, we warned them. Yeah, it was just a few months after we got operational. We got operational, I think, not completely operational. We started moving in June. We had planned to be operational in October. And in August 31st is when we got the word, the cancellation there. And it was just a couple of months there between when we first got there and they offered to buy us all this equipment and everything. And even the director wrote an article for the local newspaper touting that they were able to attract a company from California to relocate to North Carolina. Just a couple of months after that, now they kicked us out.
Right, with no explanation.
No explanation to this day. But you and I know the reason.
I mean, it seems that electron microscope analysis of HIV goes to the very heart of the matter. That is that is being questioned by a lot of people is does this virus called HIV really exist? There's something in the lab. There's something in the lab that they're culturing.
Something in the lab. That's right.
But the question is whether that thing in the lab actually represents something that's in the humans who've been diagnosed with AIDS or diagnosed HIV positive.
And you're absolutely right, and it's never been demonstrated. I'm convinced that thing that they call HIV that you can culture in the lab is a laboratory artifact. It was accidentally created in the laboratory, Robert Gallo's lab or someplace, anyway, and it got blown out of all proportion. But nobody's ever demonstrated that that thing is in any human being or causes any pathology, whatever.
When they do cell culturing, which is where this all started, right? They take some blood from a human being or possibly some other body fluid, but I think normally blood, the serum, and then they add it to a culture of cancerous cells.
Yeah.
But there's also a bunch of other things that they add. So can you describe some of those things?
Yeah, they add phytohemagglutinin, they add IL-1 or 2, I forget which. They had to mix the normal cells with leukemia cells or cancer cells. They basically had to do some really, really strange things to produce the production of these vesicles or viral-like particles in cell culture. And the thing that astounded me when I first learned about this was we are told that HIV infects T helper cells, white blood cells.
Right.
Normal white blood cells, not leukemia cells, normal white blood cells. They couldn't grow it in normal white blood cells. Yeah, I thought that's very, very strange. They had to do these really bizarre things that are known to, first of all, the cancer cells, the leukemia cells, are known to produce retroviral particles or particles that look retroviral-like, that they're infected with these things. At least, I'm not a virologist. I got this from reading. And those vesicles that you opened up our interview here with about the difference between them. Can you tell the difference between a viral particle and vesicle? Most people cannot. I'm beginning to only because I've been working on it for a while, but I'm not the person to make that choice. I'm not the expert. So anyway, you know, people have been looking at viruses using TEM in blood, in urine, sputum, pus, feces, tissues of all sorts. I mean, they still, at Duke University here in North Carolina, they have one of the premier EM labs in the country for sure, and where they do viral diagnosis via TEM every day in humans.
But it's not been approved by the FDA.
It has not been approved by FDA, so I think Ms. Peel should go down there and have a word with those folks.
Yeah, start to intimidate them. But of course, when they're actually finding something, you know, if they're playing the game right, according to the right rules, then I guess it's not a problem. Seems like you were playing the game not with the right rules.
Well, we're the underdog, you know, and we're not in the in crowd. The winners are the ones that get to, you know, make the rules up.
Yes. Well, I mean, two things have collapsed recently. OMSJ and viral forensics, and OMSJ was sued by the other side, and that's kind of bogged everything down there. There's maybe hope for the future. Do you see any hope for the future of electron microscope analysis of HIV?
There's a teeny tiny glimmer of hope in the sense of it actually happening. I mean, technically, it's a no-brainer.
Right.
Really, it's not a no-brainer. And at that meeting that you and I attended, there was this gentleman, I forget his name, from South Africa, who in the men's room had a conversation with me.
Some of the best conversations happening.
about, you know, what it would cost to set up the lab, you know, get this thing going again. And I told him, I don't want to put those numbers on your program right now. And he said, yeah, that's doable and everything. Well, I'm standing by.
You haven't heard from him yet.
Well, but I don't expect to hear it too soon. I mean, when you're talking about this, a major undertaking like that, in the sense of Think of all the political things, hurdles this guy is going to have to run into back in South Africa. I lived in South Africa for 15 months, so I know what goes on there.
South Africa went from Thabo Mbeki, who was, I think, the only major politician around the world who was questioning the HIV/AIDS paradigm, to Jacob Zuma, who went along with the game because Jacob Zuma was in the game for his own personal aggrandizement, and AIDS means money. So I'm sure Jacob Zuma didn't want to stop the flow of money into South Africa. I don't know. There's a new president right now. I don't know if he has any different opinion on HIV at all. I haven't heard anything.
I think it's Ramaphosa. Ramaphosa.
Yes.
But I think he's just interim. When I was there, I knew something about him, but it's been so long since I left South Africa in 2006. And frankly, I've forgotten a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, what was supposed to happen in South Africa was this, it was very high HIV positive rate. I remember one paper from a few years ago where they did a survey of young people in South Africa, and they found that among young black women, they were up around 20% HIV positive. Should have been a massive death rate from HIV, and yet the population of South Africa is still growing rapidly.
Yeah, that's right. Rian Milan and some other people down there, famous journalists and writers in South Africa, actually looked into that stuff. And instead of finding masses of bodies out there, all these undertakers and coffin makers were building these things, anticipating huge death rates, and their coffins are going unused, because it never happened. Just the opposite. There's a population explosion.
Right, and a very young population.
Very young.
Yes. That's interesting. Another thing you brought up at the conference when you were talking about viral forensics is the fact that there's really only one laboratory HIV. Gallo called his HTLV-3B. Montagnier called his LAV or BRU. And then you were using something called NL4, but you were saying that these are really all the same thing.
They are. That was confirmed by our consultant who had actually cultured HIV for 18 years, I believe, for the vaccine work. His name is Chris Rold, and he confirmed that there's only one HIV that's being cultured in laboratories around the world. Only one, even though it goes by five different names.
Right.
And it's all the same virus. And the NL4 was the one that we got at the University of Massachusetts at Worcester from Gottlinger.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when they used to think that Gallo's virus and Montagnier's virus were different, they formed a hybrid of one end of Gallo's virus and the other end of Montagnier's virus. They cut them in half, and then they fused those two end to end. One end of it, sort of like the front end's got the zebra, front end's got a horse.
Why would they do that?
Well, they were, who knows? who knows? One thing that they were able to do, that it turns out that NL4, that hybrid, they do all these manipulations to it and everything. It turns out that that's one of the easiest ones to culture. It's even though they're all the same, they all come from the same virus, but when they cut it apart and fused it back together, they did something.
Okay, so what do you mean by it's the same? Because you also said that there's 748,589 different HIV sequences that have been recorded, and yet you're saying that all the lab virus is the same. So how do you reconcile those rather different statements?
Yeah, as it turns out, there's no such thing as an isolate that are identical. Even Gallo's virus and Luc Montagnier's virus, even though Gallo stole it from Montagnier, they're not even identical. But they're so closely similar, they know how much these retroviruses, they mutate all the time. They're changing their sequences all the time in cell culture. Probably in vivo if they do anything in vivo, like in animals. But it's problematic whether that even happens. All right, so in culture, these things are changing all the time. So if you take one sample of Gallo's virus and you put it in one flask and then another sample in another flask and you culture them, these things are going to wind up changing after a time. but they're going to be very, very similar. If it was truly a unique isolate, for example, a different virus isolate from a different animal, for example, like they have with these rodents, about 3,000 different types, I believe they've cataloged them, that those will be decidedly different. The problem was, even though Gallo's virus and Montagnier's virus are not identical, they were shockingly similar from the virologist's perspective, and that's what nailed Gallo.
So they believe that HIV mutates all the time. So yeah. Does that mean that if I had HIV in my body, that if you took a sample from my arm, the blood in my arm, from my leg, at different places at different times, that the HIV would have different sequences?
Hypothetically, but nobody's ever done that, so you don't know.
But, okay, so another thing they use in criminal cases is they call it phylogenetic analysis, right? So they take a sequence out of David Raznik's accused of having sex with under the influence of HIV. So they take some blood from you, they take some blood from your girlfriends or boyfriends, they take some blood, they take some sequences out of the laboratory, and then they draw a family tree, and they say, your HIV looks like this woman's HIV, therefore you gave it to her.
Right.
But if in your body you have many different kinds of HIV, how do they do a family tree on one sequence?
Damned if I know.
That makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense. But yeah, think of that number that you already mentioned, the one that was about 750,000 HIVs that had been cataloged as of 2017. That there's only 9,800 nucleotides in HIV.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to convey this to the audience listening to this thing, but it's like shuffling a deck of cards. You know, when you have a deck of cards, now how many, you shuffle these things and you got all these different hands, but how many of them are straight flushes? You know, not too many.
Right.
And how many of these mutated HIVs are going to, they might look like GAG-POL-M, the three genes of retrovirus, but they're not going to be functional.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have, it's like, think of a word or Shakespeare or something like that. You can start changing the spellings of these words, or you can start mixing and matching and just scrambling them up. And you'll still, if you don't shuffle it too much, you'll still recognize it's Hamlet or something like that, although you recognize problem. But if you do it billions of times, you know, at some point, you don't have a clue what you started with.
Right, like you could start with Shakespeare and you scramble enough letters and you just got gibberish. The chances of you turning Shakespeare into Dickens is virtually zero. There's somebody who's communicated with me a few times using a back channel who I think uses a name that's not his real name, and he has as a hobby, he looks for HIV sequences in just about anything that he can find. So if somebody publishes a sequence from an animal or from some other virus, and he finds HIV sequences in just about every sequence that's published, and then he writes a letter to the journal saying, oh, I found HIV in this sequence of something completely unrelated to HIV, and nobody seems to care.
Yeah, well, why would they care? I mean, they can't afford to care.
I guess, yes. Yes.
If you care, you get shut down.
Right, right. Your career. I remember being in Peter Duisberg's lab, and one of his German friends came in. I don't remember the name, and I wouldn't use it anyway. And he said, "He said, where's Peter?" I said, "I'm waiting to see Peter. I think I'm going to interview him or something. And so if you hang around, he'll probably show up." And I said, did you work with Peter before? He said, yes, I worked with him in Germany. And we're sitting there and he says, Peter's wrong, you know. And I said, well, you believe that Peter's wrong about whether HIV is the cause of AIDS? He said, no. He's wrong to bring it up. That's not the job of a scientist. A scientist is supposed to do their work and leave the politics to somebody else. But it's like if there's a major theory, like HIV causes AIDS, And you believe it's wrong. I would think as a scientist you had a duty. But the reality is if you exercise that duty of like your duty of saying it doesn't appear that there's HIV in live blood or in fresh blood, or that Peter saying I don't think HIV causes AIDS, you're going to be savagely attacked.
Yeah, I mean, this fellow was using the Nuremberg argument, you know? Oh, I'm not a Nazi. I was just following instructions, you know? It wasn't my place to bring up ugly, unfortunate things that were going on. I mean, that argument doesn't fly.
Yes, I just drove the truck to take people to the gas chamber. Yeah. I had no choice, right? Yes. Sadly, that's true. And of course, the image of science is that scientists argue with each other all the time, and they keep arguing until they reach a consensus. But the reality is that the consensus is imposed early in the discussion, and as we've seen, it's often wrong.
You know, I've been doing science for a long time. I never heard the word consensus before AIDS. You know, I never heard it. And scientists, I was in a politically unimportant area before AIDS with HIV. I was a protease guy. I was a big frog in a small pond. And we argued all the time. It was healthy. It was even fun. I mean, that's the essence of science. You can't really test an idea without arguing it.
Right.
You know, pros and cons. You got to get all sorts of, there's no science without argument. And there's no science with consensus. Those two things are antithetical to science.
Yeah, one of the things that rubs me the wrong way if we talk about climate change is the papers that say that 97% of climate scientists believe that anthropogenic global warming is occurring. There's two problems with that. One is that I don't really think the 97% is actually accurate. I think they've cooked the numbers. And they always come up with 97%, never 96 or 98 or 92 or whatever. Right. But the second problem is, so what? So what if 96% of scientists... I mean, let's go back to the time of Einstein and poll the people on whether... on the theory of relativity. I'm sure if you'd described it to physicists at that time, everybody but Einstein would have said, you're crazy. Time doesn't slow down. You know, gravity doesn't have waves. All the things that Einstein came up with, they would say, you're crazy. Then, you know, 10 or 20 years later, everybody agrees that Einstein was a brilliant scientist who radically changed everything.
Yeah, I mean, that whole thing, science only advances because what people used to think turns out not to be the whole story or turns out to be wrong. And it's usually individuals. In the sciences, it's usually a single individual who discovers something, mm-hmm. you know, and changes things. In fact, the big argument wasn't so much whether or not time doesn't slow down or anything. In fact, most of his colleagues immediately accepted the special theory of relativity. The big break was it broke with Newton, Isaac Newton, mm-hmm. you know, which was the consensus, if you want to use that word, only in the sense that, well, everybody worked with it because it worked.
Right.
You know, that was the beauty of it. And Einstein comes in here. Fortunately, physics was different in those days. If you had a good argument, you could convince other people, like Max Planck and virtually everybody else said, man, this is great. I mean, Einstein was accepted really, really quickly, which is astounding when you think about it. Mm-hmm. That's hard nowadays. The thing now, you have to be a group of people who sort of think the same thing in order to get anywhere. Individuals are the ones that create and make the real big discoveries in science and arts.
Right. Groups tend to suppress individuals as opposed to bringing them forwards. And if they do bring somebody forwards, it might be like Lysenko in Russia, where the political establishment brings the wrong person forwards and imposes his views on everything. So let's finish.
He was the Robert Gallo of his day.
Yes. we got to wrap up here. We're running out of time. So you're also writing a book on cancer, which I presume covers the aneuploidy theory. So how is that going?
Well, after that, the two weeks in Europe, and the fact that we're buying a house, and I got sick after the trip, I have not worked on that book for three or four weeks. But once we get moved into the new house and it settles down, I want to get back on it. One thing is I keep reading, though, and I'm very, very excited about doing this book. It's a very exciting story. And I think, as I mentioned the other time that we were on the program about this, I got that suggestion to put more of me in the story. It really makes a big difference. I'm putting the AIDS stuff, how it linked, how working with Peter Duisberg and the AIDS led us both. The AIDS itself didn't lead us to aneuploidy, but we were both free to mm-hmm. work on whatever we wanted to, because we couldn't get funded to do anything by anybody. And Peter went on aneuploidy, and I started studying it. Lo and behold, man, we both took off and made the biggest discoveries, I think, of our lives.
Right.
His life and my life. Yeah. So I want to tell this story in plain language for people so that they can share the same excitement about it.
Well, that's interesting that money would be a shackle that would stop you from discoveries.
Oh, it's the biggest. It's absolutely the biggest. Money has killed science.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you. When you consider I don't know if there's millions of people who would be classified as scientists, certainly working in science at various levels, from technicians up to laboratory directors. I don't really see big advances in health. I see a lot of new drugs, a lot of new procedures, but are those new drugs making our lives better?
No, just the opposite.
And
just
is anybody opposite. Looking at, you know, instead of a new drug for depression, is somebody looking at why is society making so many people depressed? Why is our environment giving so many people cancer?
Yeah.
Why do so many people have diabetes? It's not for a lack of a drug. You know, I think it's That's environment, right. nutrition, things like that. And there doesn't seem to be as much money in that as there is in developing a new chemical.
That's it. It's so simple. Money. The pharmaceutical industry, the NIH, the Department of Health and Human Services, all those things are together. It's political, and trillions of dollars. Yes. That's what's corrupted the whole shooting match.
Okay, well, Raz, now I'm thoroughly depressed. I think we're going to have to end this conversation.
Okay.
But thank
well,
you.
The bright spot are individuals. Forget the institutions.
Yes.
Find the interesting individuals.
Yes. And I have a lot of those on my show, and you're one of them. So thank you for joining me today.
It's always a pleasure.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 188 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, a question, or a suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.